I figure out how to share the screen.
Go ahead.
There we go. So I want to give a short presentation about the different kinds of time-related data and their processing systems that I've very often in this basically in the networking field. I'm actually a data management specialist, not a networking specialist. And I'm going to talk about three different types fairly briefly, and then go into a little bit more depth about temporal databases. But there's three kinds of notions I've seen. One is a streaming database or a stream processing engine. And the idea is you receive continually receive large amounts of incoming data, and you can process it very quickly, partly because you keep very little state.
Ed, could you go into presentation mode, please? Thanks.
Pardon? Presentation mode? Is this better? Yeah. So you keep very little state. Now this has some relationships to time series databases because it uses a lot of the same concepts and constructs. But the idea is you don't keep very much data around, and instead it's more like something you use to reduce records to put into a time series database. So a couple of popular systems which could be considered stream processing engines are Storm and Flink. A time series database is, from what I've seen, it's kind of a new construct. And basically the idea is to store KPIs, to put it crudely. And there's just basically periodic or reasonably periodic measurements of some entity. And there's a strong emphasis on time series analytics. And so if your stream processing engine is emitting a number of packets transmitted by an interface, the time series database might store these over a long period of time and allow various analytics on them. And a couple of popular systems which are time series databases are Influx and TSDB. But there's a third notion, and I want to concentrate on the difference between the second and the third notions. A temporal database stores current and past conditions of an entity. So, for example, continuing this example, you might want to keep track of the interface state. Say, is it up or is it down, or is it in a degraded mode? A couple of systems which can implement temporal databases are Postgres and MariaDB. So starting off as an example, working up to temporal databases, when I talk about stream processing engines, I did some work in this quite a while ago, as you can see. But the system is still in use. It's currently being used as an analytics XApp in the ORAN RIC project. And this is this system we built. It's very, very oriented towards a low-level network record processing. And in its use in the RIC project, we're gathering network elements from a variety of sources. And so we have a big mesh stream coming in, and we do a lot of processing, and then hopefully a much smaller metric stream comes out. And in some nice in some nice time series that our time series database can process. So in this example, it's going to be producing messages per interface. It likely produces a lot of other KPIs as well. So moving on to time series database, I did some work on this also a number of years ago. I don't want to talk about that system. I want to talk about a much more modern system. So I'm going to talk in the context of Influx. So what happens is you gather various records from this external source, from some collector. Well, we're going to say that we're gathering the data from that stream processing engine, just messages per interface. And we're going to get records which say something like at 1 o'clock, interface G0 produced, processed five messages. And what a time series database kind of wants to do is put it into a data structure which sort of looks like this. Not exactly, but this is a way to conceptualize it. So there's a table, messages per interface, and you have a time dimension going down, and across you have the names of the entities. So you have interface G0, interface G1, and interface G2. And then you can perform a variety of analytics on this. You can look for periods of peak use. You can compute running averages and so on and so forth. So I spent some time reading Influx actually a little bit ago and again recently. And from what I'm able to pick up, the way they actually try to store the data is in these columns. So for the messages per interface table, there's going to be a region which stores information or the numbers associated with interface G1, and it's going to store them all reasonably contiguously. Not exactly contiguously, there's a lot of tricks to play, but think about it. It's just one long, big long strip of memory. And so it winds up being the case that in terms of data management, there's a lot of advantages to this kind of a layout. Because if you're often processing this stream to compute something, then it's good if it's all in a compact region. This improves cache performance. It also tends to make the data more homogeneous, which improves its your ability to compress it. And these are all things which TSDB appears to do from its reading and my understanding of how these things typically work. So a system like TSDB, or rather like InfluxDB, it's going to have a specialized architecture and specialized languages for time series processing. And that's why if you actually happen to have KPIs, it can be a very good option. But the problem is it's optimized for storing and processing these KPIs. It's not optimized to be a general purpose database. And there's if you look at their materials, they actually say this fairly explicitly in at least a couple of places. And so these are a couple of links where I found them saying, don't use this as a general purpose database or you're not going to be happy. So,
So just a quick question back there. So those G1, G0, G2, should I mentally think about those as sort of, you mentioned a block of memory. I guess in the schema or the actual database technology itself?
In the actual database technology. So the way if you took a conventional relational database, it might try to do some clustering of these messages, but it's not going to be quite the same sort of a very specialized layout. It might scatter records for G1 all over the place. In fact, it's more likely to intermingle records from G1 with records from G0. And it's a little bit more likely to store them more strictly in time of arrival, just because that's how it can append to a table.
So in this specialized database, you basically identify there'll be sort of a G0 track. And it knows to try to keep those things together.
Yeah, in fact, there is such a notion within InfluxDB, and it warns you that if you have too many of these entities, too many of these tracks, then performance is going to suffer.
I see. And as with all memory allocation-ish sort of things, is there also the notion of a block of, I reserve this amount of block to G0?
There's a lot of tricks to play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there's a lot of tricks to play. Yeah. I can talk about this for the next hour.
Yeah. That's fine. Go ahead. I think I got the idea. Thanks.
But this is the way it's trying to lay out the data. It's a very specialized layout. If you have this layout, you can be a lot faster than what you would get with a conventional relational database. And that's the point I'm trying to make. And they say this, and they say, we're really great at doing KPIs. We're not so great at being a general purpose database. And there's more issues beyond the data layout. It kind of assumes that data is arriving pretty much in order, and the transactional semantics a little bit different, and so forth.
Okay, I have a question. Let's say you G1, you have the block data, right? The block, do mm-hmm. this block, it's, do you have the capacity, say, what is the set of data? You don't have a capacity in here, right? Do we concern, right?
So you shouldn't assume that there is only a single block that it stores it in. So it might have a collection of, say, 4K blocks. So there's a lot of flexibility it can have in the way it lays out the data, and that's why I don't want to go too deeply into it. So after a while, I'm just going to start speculating and talk about how various other systems can manage these. But the key thing is it tries to arrange the data to optimize performance for computing KPIs on time series.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And from reading the way they describe how the system works, this is what I'm coming up with.
Okay.
And this would be in line with best practices for other very high performance databases. But anyway, the key thing is it's optimized for time series. If you have KPIs, this is great. If you have general purpose data, not so much. And they say so up front. So I want to talk about a different notion of time. And this is called a temporal database. And it's just trying to keep track of the state of something over time. I did some actually fairly recent work on this, which I'll come back to because I can this will provide implementation examples. So as with the time series database, as with the streaming stream processing engine, I'm glossing over a lot of details, often on purpose because I can spend all day on them. There's multiple motions of time. This Wikipedia link actually provides a pretty good description of the concepts of technologies in temporal databases. But the main idea is we have our three interfaces, G0, G1, and G2, and we just want to keep track of their state. I'm going to make it really simple. Are they up or are they down? Red means down, green means up. And so there's no strict time over here. You can do something kind of similar with the time series database, but again, it's really not what it's designed for. But what we're going to do is we're just going to say, we're just going to try to keep track of these intervals. So we don't really have timestamps anymore, but rather we have time intervals. And I'll show you some examples over here. And this is actually something which is very, very much a part of a temporal database. Each record has a validity interval associated with it, which is just a start time, end time. And this end time might be open. So that's what the dash represents. It means, you know, it's still valid as far as I can tell. And for us, and again, we're going to be tracking entities in a table, but now what we're going to say is the validity interval of records for a specific entity are not overlapping. So you can't be in two different states at the same time. So this might be an example of this representation. You're going to face G0s in the down state from 1 o'clock to 1:05. The upstate from 105 to 120, down from 120 to 121, and it came back up again to 121. It's still up, so far as we can tell. So there's a lot of different kinds of questions you can ask, but the question most relevant at hand is something called a time travel query. So you can say which interfaces were up at 109. So we're going back in the past. And the way we go back in the past is just go through the data for G0, and we find which of these intervals does 109 fit into. And it fits into this one over here. It's 109 is between 105 and 120. So G0 is up. It fits into here. So G1 is up. It fits into here. So G2 is up. So all three interfaces are up at time 109. And this lets us do time travel. There's other things you can ask, but this is really the main point here. So I want to I'm going to make the case that I think what you really want for this for the system is a temporal database. So I want to do a deeper dive. It's going to get a little bit technical, but I'm going to try to make it as simple as possible. This draws on the experiences I had in implementing the system described in this paper I referenced previously. So in that paper, we're trying to come up with a graph query system which can navigate navigate paths and the kinds of graphs which we saw as being common in descriptions of virtualized networks. And so we decided that, well, it seemed to us that all the nodes and edges actually have a fixed schema, which is not the usual way to do things. So that's what we decided upon. That made it pretty easy to implement on top of Postgres. And by the way, this is also a notion which is appearing in a newer system called TigerGraph. Now, something that's notable about this paper is that it had the first published description of a graph database with full temporal querying. And that might seem like an achievement, but actually it was really easy to do. We just leveraged the temporal capabilities of Postgres, specifically using the temporal tables extension. And so I got this functionality working in about 2 days. So I'm going to go into an even deeper dive talking about how one can build temporal tables in Postgres. I want to point out that MariaDB also has built-in temporal table support, but I'm much more familiar with the way it's done in Postgres. So this is what you do. You start with a table, any table that you want to make it temporal. You want to be able to ask in the past queries. Well, you have to add the interval, the timestamp interval field. I'm going to call it valid. And this is actually easy in Postgres because it's a native type, as interval types. And you can ask queries questions about it. Does this interval contain a point? Do two intervals overlap? And so on and so forth. Then we're going to create a duplicate table, told. It's not exactly a duplicate. You have to change the key definitions a little bit and insing and indexing and a few other things. But it's, for the most part, it's the exact same table. It should have the exact same layout, for example. Then we're going to install the temporal tables trigger on T. So this is a trigger is something that occurs every time there is a any kind of an access to T. In this case, it's only for updates. And what this trigger is going to do is that if nothing comes in and it modifies or deletes any record in T, then the old value gets pushed to T old. And as a result of that, T is always going to have the current state of the database, and T old is always going to have the prior states. And when these updates get pushed, the valid time timestamp interval gets adjusted a little bit. Its upper timestamp is set to the time when the update occurred. When update comes in, the valid interval is the lower bound is set to the current time. The upper bound is set till, as far as you know, it's still true. So this is your current state database. All your updates, all your queries on your current state database occur over here, and there's no change whatsoever required to implement this. If you want to look at in the past states, you have to query two places, the current state database and the prior state database, and see which one contains the record at the time you're interested in. So that's kind of cumbersome, but fortunately there's a way to fix it up. You create a view called thistory, which is just the combination of the two, and the database will rewrite all the queries to for you, so it will query both t and t old. So this is the upshot. T is your current status view. There are no changes to it in terms of the interface. It is completely transparent if all you're doing is accessing the current state database. T history is your full history view. You do have to change the queries a little bit. You have to say when in the past you're interested in searching, but otherwise you don't have to worry about any of this maintenance, any of these maintenance issues. So basically you get transparent access to both the current state database and the historical state database, all in one package. So just some conclusions, there's multiple ways to manage time-oriented data, and it's best to use the framework or technology that fits best. I had good experiences with Postgres and temporal tables. As I said, there is transparent access. You don't change any query at all. There's a small effect on current state performance because you have to push the old values into told, but that's what you have to do anyway. You have fast access to historical data because you can index this validity interval, and even if you have many records in your past state, you can still find the one that you need fairly quickly. I ran a number of experiments. I found there was a slowdown, maybe a 30% slowdown. 30 to 50% slowdown, of course, depending upon the query data and so on and so forth. That's the kind of overhead you pay when you're at issuing historical queries. A query on the current state table has no performance impact. What I was trying to argue against, especially when I built this thing, is there's a notion that while we don't know how to do temporal databases, especially temporal graphs, so we're just going to take snapshots and then maybe collect a lot of deltas. But this is far more space and time efficient than snapshots and deltas. And it also has the additional benefit that it's much, much easier to use and maintain than collections of snapshots and deltas. So that's basically it. I was hoping to keep this talk reasonably short because I know there's other issues to talk about today. So I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Ted. Can I ask you a quick question about performance there? Did you measure the actual update? I presume the update is relatively more costly.
I didn't measure the update times. I was more interested in query times. But it is going to be more expensive because you have to push all these old values out. Now, exactly the thing is, you have to push the old values out anyway somehow.
Yep. Yeah. No. Fair enough.
I have a question. Would you envision that basically we would, in this project, we would essentially keep a time series database in addition to a relational database because they're each sort of specialized for their own functions? Or could a sort of a section of a database be used and set up as a time series function and you would have one database?
From what I was seeing in the discussions, I'm not seeing that this project wants to store a lot of KPIs. I thought that was a little bit more the domain of something like DCAE. If you want to store KPIs, but you don't have a lot of them, I would just use Postgres to store them. If you have a major project that needs to store a lot of KPIs with very high performance on them, then that's when you start wanting to think about using a time series database. And it's kind of a matter of how much you're doing in the one hand versus the other. If you have lots and lots of KPIs and you want to store a little bit of state about some of the things that you're storing these KPIs about, then I would probably do everything in influx, to tell you the truth. If I'm mostly storing states of systems, like states of something like this, the state of your interfaces, I would definitely go for the temporal data representation. So what I'm seeing that this project is all about is storing some fairly complex data. And every now and again, there is some change to it. But it's not as though for every thing that you're storing, it's getting updated on a permanent basis.
So I, the bulk PM project and the real-time PM projects use cases, which started in R2 and have gone on steadily through R6 and R7, they are very concerned, of course, with performance measurements and KPIs, which are products of performance measurements, analytic products of performance measurements. And of course, real-time performance measurements, which is a stream of time-oriented data. So NAP definitely cares about that kind of data. And DCAE is the collector of the data. Those are VEST events that come in. And of course, the virtual event streaming listener resides in DCAE. And of course, the actual analytics that would take the data and do something meaningful with it, like, I see some threshold has been crossed or I've triggered some policy based on KPIs, I need to take this action. That's, of course, what DCAE does. but of course, the key question is what happens to the actual data that comes in? And there's sort of two major branches, right? So the non-real-time data, the PM data, comes in through a message, a VES event that says, the PNFs or VNFs say, I've got a bunch of data here. You can go get it, basically. And that's the message that comes in. And then ONAP would go and get that body of information. Next is the real-time branch, which is basically, I set up a connection, a dedicated connection to receive data every so often, every minute or whatever, every 30 seconds. And then that just comes in. But I think maybe we need to have a conversation with Vijay. How does ONAP actually store the data? I don't think that's stored in DCAE, right?
Well, I don't want to prescribe anything to anyone, but I'll give the example of what we're doing in the RIC project. So the reason why we're using this GS tool is that it is designed to be very reactive. It's not as reactive as we want it to be, so we're still updating it. But it's used as being the real-time analytics engine. And so one of the things that it does is it generates a stream of KPIs and pushes them to a collector. It's also designed to push various kinds of information to other XApps, which are trying to control the 5G network. But we're also considering the use of InfluxDB for the storage and analytics of these KPIs that are being produced by this MCXApp. That's this analytics XApp that's on the previous slide. So the idea is you might want to use multiple technologies. Technically speaking, everything that we could do in Influx, we could do in the stream processing engine, but then there's a certain self-serve problem where every time somebody wants a slight variation on the basic data we're producing, they have to ask us, and then maybe 3 months later we'll get it out to them. Whereas if it's in a database, they can just go and write the query and then they have access to it. And so we don't have, we're not polluting the main engine with hundreds and hundreds of queries, which can be computed using the basic metrics we're putting out. So it's sort of like in this project, we are very strongly considering the use of multiple technologies and using the one in the most appropriate place possible. And then that's kind of what's going on here. There's other engines which talk about the current state of what the 5G network looks like. That's a whole other thing on the side. I don't want to. It doesn't keep previous states to any significant degree. That's not really the issue at because it's trying to make real-time control decisions.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you. So I think maybe we should just engage Vijay because he'll run across this problem at some point. DCAE works with KPIs. Where is that huge body of KPIs stored? Is it just stored in some local DCAE store? In which case, it seems like the CNPS would be the better place to manage that kind of data.
Can I just
can I comment?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to comment on, I don't know whether we seem to be jumping from use cases through to technology choices and back to use cases again.
Yep.
It would be good if we were able to focus what the specific problems that we're trying to solve here. Maybe we're not trying to eat the entire world with this project, as it were. Yeah. What I was considering we were talking about here was looking at things like attribute value change events coming in from the network, which indicate that a particular configuration parameter has changed. And that then would tie in, I think, to the sort of temporal aspect that you were talking about there. KPIs I see as being a slightly different or a very significantly different characteristics type of use case altogether, where at a particular point in time you want to maybe have a counter which represents the values of all of the things of a particular type that a packet's processed or that sort of thing during the last time interval. So those are kind of, and then the third use case is I just want to go and I don't care about history. I just want to see what is the current expected state of my network at this point in time. And I think those are three maybe slightly distinct capabilities that we need to kind of compartmentalize and then see whether or not we can select one technology that suits all of them. Maybe we need to have a mix of technologies or maybe we need to maybe have more loose coupling.
The argument I'm trying to make is the second two can all be done with the same system. You don't need two different systems to store the current state and the full history.
Yeah, I can concur that there are technologies out there that do that, and you mentioned there are some trade-offs that we take there in terms of performance, and that trade-off, I guess we need to dig into it a little bit to see whether that's an acceptable trade-off. I don't wonder why stream processing, and I'm not an expert in this area by any stretch of the imagination, but I know that a lot of people do contend that you can use a stream-based system like Kafka to persist the data and use that for both the current state and prior state, and you build up your picture over time. So you kind of seem to rule that one out altogether at the beginning. So I'd be interested to see
So a modern stream processing engine like Flink is actually built on top of Kafka. And so that is a valid thing to do, but asking people to do rock Kafka is kind of rough.
So it's basically around about the usability of the interfaces rather than the suitability of the technology.
Yeah. So Kafka, I've used it. It works really surprisingly well. Modern stream processing engines. Flink does something different than what my tool does, but it does it very well because it's built on top of Kafka. So that's definitely an option, but you have to think about what kind of layer you're adding on top of the rock Kafka to make it possible for normal human beings to or normal developers to come in and get the information they need quickly.
Okay. Very good. Okay. To my mind, yeah, go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, my takeaway from this one is that, I mean, last week we discussed this and we talked about low coupling, but we also opened the door to the fact that the database technology itself could support multiple different types. And in this case, you're showing us two implementations that quite easily, and how to use them to quite easily support both current and temporal data. And I think we need to take this on board because it is a very efficient way to do this if your use case requires both current and temporal. And I don't think we should be excluding it. I also think that it's very valid that if we are processing CM change notifications and CM data, that when we do that, we should be able to inform others that something has been persisted. And that's where we get into the loose integration. So it may well be that we're allowing somebody to do KPIs if they're not taking it directly off the DMAP themselves, and then using that themselves in a time series database, if that's their use case. And that's where the low coupling comes into play. So I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, but taking this on board and building on the conversation from last week, we do need to be very careful about the SPI that we have between the core of the CPS and the API, essentially how it talks to the underlying database technology, because not all technologies will have the ability to do both current and temporal state. So this is a good thing. But we need some workers to figure out exactly how we'll fit it into what we're trying to achieve with the CPS. That's my take on it.
So, Tony, do you think...
I have some comments, yeah.
Just a really quick one. So, Tony, do you think that we should probably just... maybe we can evolve it, but maybe it seems like the time series management and things is something that's pretty fundamental to a lot of... use cases that we could think of, and of course we can't do everything at once, but maybe we should say that's one of the things that we should be considering. I don't think that's in our it's not in the project charter, as it were.
I think it is actually.
Is it?
Yeah, I think we do talk about historical.
That's true, and
I think this both temporal and time series fall under this historical for me, but maybe that's just me being naive.
I think we should also just highlight not just history, but also this whole time. For me, it's more than just history, right? It's also the management of something that arrives in time, like it's a time series, right? I mean, time series, the nature of time series is a little different, we're saying, than the nature of a relational database, right? So that maybe we should just call that out, I think.
Yeah. So can I comment? Sorry, I joined late. Yeah. So one is, I think it was Kieran who was first his comment I heard, and I would underscore that point. I think he said there are three types of data, and the first one was the KPIs. I think we should and I believe, Ted, if I heard you right, the first part was the KPI, and the second two were config state and history of the state, and this way approaches handles type two and type three. My first point is that type one, actual KPIs, counters that are stored, we should not mix up in CPS. And I think just speaking, and my second point is also everything that Ted is presenting, you should just keep in mind. I'm sure most of you know, but I want to just underline it. It is coming from the viewpoint of an operator managing a network. And so there are a lot of different solutions for keeping KPI, PM data, and it's usually a time series and it's managed. You don't get into the state stuff. And keeping track of configuration state, real-time state, and being able to know what was the state at some time, maybe not 6 months, but sometimes you do really need to know exactly what was it yesterday and 2 days before there is some troubleshooting kind of condition. So we have thought a lot about, and Ted has particularly thought a lot about this notion that KPI, PM KPIs, and he's worked with that too, but PM KPIs are different from this config properties, and we need to keep track of the change events. And so that's just saying everything that's being presented here is based on a lot of experience with what is needed to manage a network. So that was the two main points, I think. So let's not mix up the PM.
I tend to agree. And in addition, the definition for what we encompass as state is also a topic of discussion, not just for configuration state as parameters for the connectivity or even IP addresses, or whether certain parameters or translation for an eNode B are set at certain levels for initiating handoffs and or neighborless or antenna tilts, those kind of configuration. I'd say even as far as the state information for a container that's running in terms of not just its resources, but even some kind of a processing so that we could, if we needed to capture that state information externally, so that when we spin up another container, we use that as a starting point for its configuration so that we can do a seamless or close to seamless reinstantiation of that network function without dropping any of the sessions that are on it. I mean, that's the final goal, which is going to take some time to define, but just the concept of what we mean by state has a huge meaning that's of value to a service provider.
Yeah, let's just say right now the design for this CNPS is the stateful configuration for network. We need to have like a version time series. We wouldn't keep up with the KPI in this database. Because the database, the KPI database, we have another database use case. In a real-time PM will be capable of tracking this KPI state. So I think right now what we try to see initially at the design stage for the run, we need to keep focus on how can we keep our current CPS, current state sync of our network, tracking all the configuration. I agree with Fred say, but for the container, well, maybe can be the CNF can be the next stage. But at least we need to see how can we keep sync up the current state of network for 5G.
We can't boil the ocean on day one, right? So, but I'm just pointing out that this is a valuable work that we shouldn't just dismiss. So let's look at it.
Agree. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a consensus to me. I mean, this is good stuff, but we do have to be practical in terms of what we can actually achieve. I would like to consider it in terms of how do we cater for different database technologies, because I will expect that we will use different technologies in this product. So I want to see and understand how to cater
right,
for this.
But let's first understand, make clear to everyone the value proposition and the sweet spot for that this addresses, and then we can worry about the nuts and bolts on how to implement it. I think this is a new concept. It needs to be understood, and this way we can get backing before we start trying to figure out how we do it. That's just a suggestion, because I'm not sure that we're clear on that yet.
Yeah, I mean, it is contextual, and we are kind of assuming what the use case is. We are absolutely doing that. So we are getting very much into technology here.
Well, I think I wanted to make this presentation because the available technology can have an effect on your architecture. And I think the point I'm trying to make is that you don't need a whole separate subcomponent to deal with history.
And I get that, and it's completely valid. And I also get the fact that this will and does change the architecture. I mean, that's my point. I mean, I see this as being a significant challenge to what the SPI looks like, to allow for the ability to swap out database management. I mean, if I use a DBMS that doesn't support this temporal, then what implication does that have on the SPI? What happens if I explicitly wanted to have a standalone temporal database, then what implication does that have on the architecture? It's those questions that I want to understand and see how it can be integrated to provide those options, which I want to do. If I have to drop them, then I have to drop them. But as a technologist, that's what I want to go on with. I want to understand that.
Yeah, so I think, it is possible to do this without explicit temporal support, although, yeah, it's going to be a lot tougher, and it's not going to be as efficient because this trigger is operating at a very low level, and so that's why it's actually reasonably efficient. I would point out that there's two different options here. One is to use Postgres. The other one is to use MariaDB. And both of these are extremely well supported. So you do have a couple of options for doing this. And these are two very mature systems with a lot of momentum behind them.
Yes, agreed.
One aspect, I don't fully understand how this T old table works in terms of managing its updates.
You never perform updates on it. The only updates that get performed on T old are the ones that this trigger is pushing into it. You never touch it yourself. In fact, you never query it.
I got that. I mean, it's kind of like an event coming from once you've made an update to the valid table, to the current state table, that triggers an event onto the T old table. But does that then create a new sort of set of entries in that table? Say, for example, I've got 100 configuration parameters and I receive an attribute value change event which updates one of those configuration parameters. That makes an update to one entry in the current state table. Does that then create an entirely new data set in the T old, or is there some way that the...
It operates at a very low level, so of course everything depends upon how you've set up your database. But if you update a single record in current state, then only that old value, that only the old value of the record gets pushed to the prior state.
Okay. An alternative implementation of this might be that your CPS might update its current state database and also send an event over DMAP to an external system, which can, like a time series database, or not necessarily a time series database, but another database technology, which can then store that as a kind of in a separate repository. Tony, that might address some of those other challenges with technology.
Yeah, those are the kind of things that I'm thinking about. I'm jumping straight to that because
this presentation, that was what I would have assumed we were going to do for this type of use case.
Yeah, that's what we discussed last week. That's exactly what the conclusion that we came to last week. But I think Ted has pointed out that we potentially are hamstringing a technology selection if we do that and ignore this capability, which I think is completely valid.
That helps me to understand then that what we're discussing. Sorry, I missed last week.
So Ted, I also have a question. If you go to the slide where you have you're showing the interval stuff. Yeah, that one. If we take a look at this and sort of burn in our mind for a second. So here you're managing data that comes in, you're managing things that have states, let's say, and have intervals within states. And then if you go back, I think it's two slides before this, maybe three. Yeah, here. So there's also data that's not necessarily, before you start talking about intervals, there's also just data that's time-oriented data. What if we have a combination of those two kinds of things we want to manage? Can that still all be done with just one database solution, or do you need a separate kind of setup for that?
I've actually done some work in that too. It gets a little bit complicated. Unfortunately, the specialized like Influx doesn't seem to have temporal database support. Temporal databases are an old notion within the database community, but there have been a lot of issues with definitions, and only recently have things like temporal support in MariaDB and in Postgres, only recently have they come out. So unfortunately, there's not a good combination of these two specialized technologies yet. So something like InfluxDB, I read over it, and I'm pretty impressed by what they seem to do. I don't know exactly what they're doing, but what they seem to do, I'm pretty impressed by, and you're going to get good performance out of it. Now, I want to point out that the traditional way of storing time series and querying them is just to use a conventional database such as Postgres. It's just that InfluxDB is going to be faster if you have a massive use case and you're massively processing these.
Absolutely. In fact, carriers are going in that direction already. That's pretty much established. But as far as a temporal database is concerned, you're saying that's also defined within MariaDB. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So what Ben is trying to get at, and this is what I did some work in this a number of years ago, and unfortunately it didn't really come to fruition, although I do have a paper about it, is that you actually want to combine these two notions. So for example, suppose that instead of messages per interface, this is bytes per interface that are being sent, and you want to compute the utilization of the interface. Well, you have no way of doing that because you don't know what the capacity of the interface is. And suppose the capacity of the interface changes from time to time. It doesn't change rapidly, but it changes from time to time. So you need to take the number of bytes per transmitted over the interface during a 5-minute interval, combine that with the speed of the interface, and then you can get the utilization. So really what you want is you want a combination of both. I think this is what Ben is kind of getting at. But I'm not seeing a lot of good integration along these lines. And I tried to do a project which didn't work out all that well, which combined the two. But I've spent a lot of time working with these kinds of things. And I suppose one of the things is you actually can make a time series database do these sorts of things and store these temporal properties. Unfortunately, they're kind of terrible at it. And that's what drove me to try to think about alternative
methods. That's good to know. That's
interesting. I was just curious. Yeah, thanks.
But I can do some more. If you guys are interested, I can do some more research and see what the state of the art is to put something together which has both state and time series. As I said, you can definitely store time series in Postgres. I think they have some specialized options for that. Postgres is not considered to be the highest performance database. Many good properties, not high performance, is not necessarily one of them. But I can try to investigate what some of these options are.
Have you created some kind of a value proposition statement for the temporal database that's easily communicated to outside people to get them interested in this and how this fits the gap other than the discussions we've had? Is there some way you could create a couple of slides that show the need for this type of database?
Well, in this graph database we built, the big issue is trying to do troubleshooting. One of the big issues is trying to do troubleshooting. And so there is a problem in the past, and the problem maybe got fixed, but you're trying to identify the root cause. If you're trying to identify the root cause, you can't do the analysis on the current state. You have to do the analysis on the past state. So if you want to do troubleshooting, period, you need this past history.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to do some kind of an auditing, like maybe you have a suspicion that a sequence of changes to your system caused a problem. So you want to go back and investigate that. Again, you need to use some sort of a history to do it. You can't just rely on the current state. And if you're telling somebody that, well, we're taking a snapshot every week and there's a bunch of deltas, it's just not.
You're right. In fact, anytime we're going to be using any kind of machine learning, we have to be able to have access to this kind of data to see what the impacts are from the changes that are triggered by the machine learning and the impacts. So this would be a way of organizing that and making it plain, more plain.
Yeah, and I think the OR Sun PCI use case is looking at machine learning in R7, right, Shankar?
Yeah. Can I also answer my answer to Fred's question? And actually, it's interesting, Fred. I was thinking about making this point about troubleshooting even before you asked this question. So in this, Ted, I was going to ask you to show that other picture. Is this the same G0, G1, G2 you had? It's the same. So I can make the point with either picture. Yeah, let's keep this one. So I'm saying the same thing Ted is saying in a different way, which is we spent a lot of time thinking about this, that suppose there was a change in a neighbor relation and you got that stream update. At the same time, there was some other event that changed some power condition. Now, you have two choices. One is, Ted alluded to this. One is you keep snapshots. I'll say every hour I know exactly what the state is. And then someone will say, oh, I have a time series database. Okay, I have the G0 event, G1 event, G2 event. I have events every minute. Okay, then you'll say, okay, can you tell me you had the G0 event and you had the G2 event. Can you tell me when I noticed packet drops, what exactly was happening? So then people say, oh, okay, that's what you want. Let me do run some analysis on my time series database, and then I'll come back and tell you what was happening. And we found that's just becomes very slow. You don't know what you're looking for. And once you figure that out, you're processing time series data to find temporal state, which is not what it was designed for. This approach is more like, yes, we're keeping all the G0, G1, G2 events, but you're keeping in such a way that if you want to know exactly what was happening at a particular time, the whole database system supports that instantly. And so it really, so Fred, you asked about the value proposition. I think it has a lot to do with managing the network.
I agree. What we're just trying to do is capture this in slides. I mean, the fact that this is being worked in another group is kind of irrelevant, Ben. All right. What we're trying to do is understand how we can sell this and create a motivation for it. And then we look at the technology, and this is a use case, and that's what we're looking for. All right. Good.
True. And Fred, to complete that thought, I think we should do this jointly. I think your comments are very insightful. I think it's not just one company saying this makes sense. It is a change in thinking, and so the value proposition should be as joint as possible. We should put all the reasons.
Yes.
And then it'll come down to dollar. I agree, it'll come down very quickly to a cost benefit analysis. Someone will say, why should I make all these changes? Who really needs this?
So that was Shankar speaking, not me, by the way. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is Shankar speaking.
Yeah.
No. I'm talking about your earlier comment, Ben, not what Shankar was just talking about.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It seems somewhat dismissive. Anyway, let's keep going, Shankar.
So I think we absolutely should do that, which is, okay, we know it is important for managing a network. It's important for troubleshooting, root cause analysis. And we are seeing more of that coming in spades as the network is changing so quickly. And some of these things, I think event streaming is more of a reason in the past few years. So the fact that the data is just streaming from the network and just being able to keep track of it is what's bubbling this up, I think. So anything to do with managing the network is what sort of cries out for this kind of way of handling it. Other than it's managing keeping track of the state and condition of the network rather than in this manner. I'm struggling to articulate it. There's a different kind of management which has been done for many years, which is I need to know the KPIs. I need to know the number of packet errors per minute, the throughput per minute, the utilization per minute. And there are many systems designed saying, okay, I get per minute data, per 10 minute data, I know what to do with it.
Right.
That doesn't help you. I guess I'm coming back to troubleshooting. Sometimes that doesn't help you figure out what happened in a particular 5 minute interval when we notice packet drops.
Yeah, but we'll just make sure we need a kind of focus, right? For the use case CNPS, we need to still tracking the current status, you know, for the phase one, you say. We still need to get the fundamental down the RAN network, you know, let's get one. I mean,
yes.
Tracking for the root cause, like a link, like in talking about KPI, you know, incremental increase, that we can do another use case, but for CNPS, for this release, we have to focus on the, you know, RAN network, right?
The current state was, so when Kiran said those three things, I think I'm paraphrasing it right. First was KPI, second was current state, third one was all including past state. And I think Tony was who analyzed, who sort of paraphrased it, that if you look only at current state, you'll get one set of answers. And if you know, well, we also need to keep track of the past state with some level of granularity, then that this is the technology choice that makes things interesting in a particular way that affects the architecture. And that's why we're also talking about this.
I think we realize there's a potential. We're just talking about communicating it and we're bringing it up just because we're having this discussion. That's why.
Sorry guys, I need to kind of cut this off because we're at time. Okay. But right before we close, I do want to make one last statement. So if I could share really quick.
And let me just quickly ask Ben, if Ted had more material, we should continue this.
Yeah, sure. Of course. It's a very interesting topic. I just want to let people know next week is the virtual DDF. If you haven't registered, please register. And I'll put the link in the chat here. So it does run from Monday through Thursday. So we will have our regular meeting next Friday on the 26th. Also, if you look at the schedule, if you were aware, it was thought that there were more proposals than could be presented, and people were complaining that there were three tracks. I mean, it's kind of a good problem. We have so many great presentations. So they actually took a poll of who to cut, essentially, which would be, so a lot of us were in a sense, waiting to see if our presentations would be in. Since then, I've learned that all the presentations are in, and they did decide to go with three tracks. We will be presenting the CNPS as well as there's also a presentation on the POC. So if you go to this schedule, you'll see, you know, the CNPS overview and which is on Thursday, and there's also the model-driven CNPS POC, which happens for one right after another on Thursday. So anyway, I just want to make everybody aware of that. So many, many normal ONAP meetings will be canceled next week. I think all meetings are canceled next week from Monday through Thursday for this joint DDF. Okay. All right. We're at time, guys. Thank you, everybody, for joining. I hope you found this useful. We had a...
Just real quick, Theodore, did you want to have any last minute thoughts or also you're going to make the slides available and this was recorded, right?
It was recorded, yes. Right.
All right.
Yeah.
I can make these available. There's nothing potential on them.
Yeah.
It was good slides. It was very good meeting. Thank you. Very good conversation.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes. Agreed.
Thank you, Ted, for your...
Thanks very much.
Very, very valuable.
Yes.
We're on to something for sure. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Bye.